I can't stress this enough how bittersweet the moment is, because you really are doing it for the rhino's protection. But it's just so, disheartening, the fact that you're taking away from the animal what they're known for. They're like the unicorns of Africa, and you're taking off this huge horn.
Welcome to Unexpected Turns with myself, Anne Dibben. Right now, I'm sitting alongside the Moselle in Germany, thinking just how lucky I am. It's also why neither of my two co-hosts, the lovely Beverly and Julie, are with me. So it's up to me to tell you about today's guest. Today, I catch up with Chloe Evans, who I first met nearly 15 years ago at a big bike race in Assen, in Holland. Appropriate, as I was yesterday watching a bike race in Belgium with some of those same youngsters who raced in Assen, Dan McClay and Owain Dool. And now, of course, I'm sitting alongside the Moselle. But just what is Chloe up to now? And how did she go from cycling to, as you heard at the very beginning there, dehorning rhinos? Listen on to find out more.
Hello, Chloe, and welcome very much to Unexpected Turns.
Hi, Anne. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
I'm fine, Chloe. You?
I have the busiest day at work whenever I have a commitment. So I'm just going to sit down in the same place so I don't sound like I'm moving around.
Oh, I'm very excited about having you on here, Chloe, because I first met you, Chloe, like 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, in Assen in Holland, of all places, at that massive cycle race we all used to go to.
Yeah, not being able to ride a bike very well.
Yeah.
And look at you now.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah, how time changes. Obviously, that was a big part of my life at that time, cycling, and definitely something that I think my dad enjoyed me doing, if he doesn't mind me saying. But yeah, it was great fun. I'm glad I met so many friends that I'm still in contact with now. So it was such a good experience for me. But definitely, I don't think my career goals.
Well, you changed, didn't you? I mean, since then, yes, you've gone, you've moved all over the world and you've gone on to do quite amazing things. But what made you decide to, move on, give up cycling and start your newer career and become a vet? How did that come about?
Oh, I wouldn't consider myself a vet at all. I haven't done any of the training. I'm just winging it. I'm faking it till I make it at the moment. But I think the first one for sure is definitely the British weather. Like, I think that's top on anyone's list that you ask of why they leave the UK. So yeah, as soon as I graduated from university, I actually studied history, which is really random. I moved to Dubai and I was working as an intern at a security company. And it was only supposed to be 3 months. I was supposed to be coming back to the UK and, sorting out my life. And then they offered me the job. And yeah, fast forward 6 years, still here. I'm at a different company now. I'm doing kind of operations and innovation management at an advanced tech group. But yeah, I'm just obsessed, as you've seen on my Instagrams and everything, with rhinos and lions and Africa. So I try and get over there as much as I can as well.
So how did that happen? So you're in Dubai, this is doing something, as you say, in tech, and this is quite far removed from no. all the work you do with your wild tracks in Africa. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely jump between things, from history to kind of like consulting to travel and animals. I think that's just part of me. I mean, I always knew from a young age I was totally obsessed with animals, and I was the one that wouldn't leave a dying bird on the street or a stray cat. I would always carry like food or something in my bag, and I knew deep down that I wanted to do something, but I also knew that I wanted to earn good money and I wanted to kind of build this like life for myself. And then I was fortunate enough to go to South Africa for the second time in March this year, and I literally sat on the plane home and I wrote my entire business plan. within like 8 hours, everything that I wanted to do, my mission, my vision. And I was like, there is a way to make this work and there are gaps in the market. And I think everything that I've done in my life so far has almost equipped me for this possibility. And I think that with the experience and, you know, I've been so fortunate to work with so many different people and so many different nationalities. That's why I love Dubai so much. There's so many different cultures and experiences. And through all of that, I feel like, you know, although I'm still pretty young, that you can add those years on and on and on. And I'm at a position where I feel like I can really make a positive impact and do something great, you know, and hopefully save some rhinos so that in 50 years time, when, you know, people go on safari, that they can still see them in the wild.
Mm. How old are you, Chloe? Sorry?
I'm 27. I've just in July. Yeah.
You've just turned 27. See, there was I thinking you were a year older than Jonathan, whereas it's you're a year older than Abby.
Yes.
So you've just turned 27. How did you come about to go to that first trip last year when you first went to Africa? How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about who you know. We have this saying in Arabic in the UAE, it's called wasta. It's like knowing someone or knowing connections. And as you can see, I'm super chatty. And I was actually at my sister's wedding. And my brother-in-law's best man, who I hadn't really met up to that point, we were doing, you know, the traditional where the maid of honor and the best man has to dance together. And obviously, I was just talking. And he said that he kind of has this, he takes like school groups just from the UK out to South Africa. And I was like, this is something that I want to introduce in the UAE. Like, this is something I want to be part of. And what I really love about this is like the mindset is all about abundance. And it's like everyone needs to help as much as they can for this cause. So I ended up going with him. And then I met the vet when I was there, Ryan. And, you know, we kind of just hit off with the same passion of what can we do? Like, how can we expand this? And then, as I said, the rest is history. On the aeroplane, the Emirates flight back, I was there like writing everything down. And then I managed to take a group of close friends out in June, and we did an elephant collaring and we dehorned 11 rhinos. And I was like, right, what is the plan for next year? We need to get all of these trips in. So now we've got a really good 2024 ahead, and hopefully lots of animals going to be saved from this.
Wow. So when you say, explain a bit about that, about dehorning the rhinos, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, it looks quite controversial or brutal, and honestly it is. I mean, I can't stress this enough how bittersweet the moment is, because you really are doing it for the rhino's protection, but it's just so, you know, disheartening, the fact that you're taking away from the animal what they're known for. You know, they're like the unicorns of Africa and you're taking off this huge horn. But it's kind of a necessity at the moment, and this is like what I would say is a short-term solution to the problem. So rhinos are critically endangered and they're being poached for this horn. And there's basically reasons why. One of them is it's used in traditional medicine. And the other one is it's seen as like a status object, you know, that it's especially in kind of the Far East, it's sold on the black market. And this is kind of where the charm of it is.
Yeah.
And what's crazy about it is the horn is made of keratin, which is exactly the same as our fingernails and our hair. So it grows back. But unfortunately, what's happening is they don't have the proper equipment. And obviously, these animals are on a game reserve. They're protected. So they're almost, you know, breaking in and hacking off with whatever tools they can find the horn, which obviously either kills the rhino immediately or it leaves it to suffer a long time. And the vets are working tirelessly to try and protect them. And then you also have the anti-poaching units, and they are there to protect the rhino against poaching. And these guys, I mean, the best way I can describe it is like frontline warfare. You know, they are truly putting their lives at risk every single time they are there. And, you know, they get into kind of these head-on collisions or within the crossfire, you know, of protecting the animal.
Mm.
So basically what we do is we find the rhinos that need doing it, and it's normally on a plan. So whether it's every year or every 18 months, dependent on the growth. And then what we will do is the maybe 3 or 4 days before we're due to do the operation, we will have rangers out who are monitoring the rhinos because they can be quite sneaky and hide when we want to do it with them.
Of course.
And then we'll send out the helicopter. And basically they will locate the animal, and then the vet will usually dart the animal from the helicopter. And what's exciting is that sometimes we get an opportunity to actually go in it as well and see the action from above.
Wow.
And then we wait like maybe 6 to 8 minutes for the animal to go down. They start doing like this marching on a spot. And basically what that means is the medicine has gone in and the oxygen's been reduced, and then the animal will start dropping to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, we all run in and we try and stabilize the rhino so it's in a good position to work in. And we put on straight away an eye mask to reduce the stress. And we also put in earplugs, and that's to reduce, rhinos have very sensitive hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So we put that in to reduce stress. And then whilst the animal is down, we usually do a lot of vet checks with that as well, because obviously it's quite stressful to put them in that position. So we want to do as much as possible. So it might be checking heart rate. It might be giving contraception if it's needed from a management perspective of the game reserve. It might be to take DNA samples. It might be, you know, to give, I don't know, anti-tick medication or something like that. Mm. And then part where you dehorn, we basically measure around 2 to 3 centimeters from the base. And then the vet will literally use a chainsaw. It is very brutal to watch. And he will saw it off and then he will file it down. And then we put a nice big spray paint on the back of the rhino, so you can see from the helicopter that this one's done. And yeah, we try and do as many as we can in a day to kind of make the operation the most efficient that it can be.
Wow. And has it stopped the poachers targeting those particular game reserves? And is the population increasing, or in that year, has there not been enough time to tell?
No, definitely. It is having an impact, and it's the most effective solution that they have at the moment. Obviously, we don't know whether this is going to continue. They have tried different techniques. There was one point where they were like putting discoloration in the horn. They were putting kind of like toxins in the horn as well at one point. This is another reason why I established Wild Tracks, is because I have a background in technology and I wanted to see, you know, is there something in the market, or can we innovate something that will help this? There's also a lot of kind of controversial discussions on the topic, which are around like legalizing the kind of rhino horn trade. And, you know, the idea of that is to almost like flood the market and to take away this kind of status symbol from it. And even discussing like maybe farming rhinos, obviously in an ethical way, but so we can breed them and then kind of have an abundance of them. But at the moment, you know, a lot of the reserves, they can't necessarily afford to keep rhinos.
Mm-hmm.
Because the poaching unit that's required is such a big feat, you know, to make sure that the rhinos are being protected and looked after. So it's a really difficult situation at the moment, but definitely the dehorning is something that we've seen results from. It's impactful, and that will be the core focus at the moment. And then in the background, we're going to try and do some work to see if there's, you know, better solutions that we can think of as time passes.
Mm. And what happens to the horns that you've removed?
Yeah, this is another one that I won't speak too much about, because to be honest, they've got a whole process and I'm not high enough to be privy to it. But everything is done in a secure way and it's tracked. So the ones that we removed in the particular reserve that we were at, we take DNA samples, as I mentioned. Everything is recorded. It's given a kind of like a code.
Yeah.
So if that horn, say it's regrown back and then it's been poached, and that is confiscated, let's say, in another country, they will be able to track that it's come from that rhino. So it's like very, very securely stored with security. And I could be wrong, but I think that it's almost on like a government level. Like it's a proper process that they've defined. It's not something that is kind of managed from an individual. So yeah, it's literally like gold dust. I mean, it's definitely not left there on the ground to kind of, even though it should be, right, like a fingernail. But it's definitely dealt with in the proper way, and also with a lot of respect for the animal, because you see what it's just gone through in order to have this, in order to protect.
Yeah, because it is very controversial, removing the horns. I know I had to read quite a bit about what you did and get my head around it. But as you say, it is, it's a necessity because they're being poked.
I mean, ultimately, I mean, ultimately, it's life or death. And it's such a an awful thing to say, but it's true. You know, in, as I said, like in 50 years time, it's a very real eventuality that we might not have rhinos in the wild. And, you know, it's such a shame because like I haven't done that much work with them yet, but I hope to do a lot more. But they're such like gentle giants. I mean, when they're down, I put my fingers in like in the mouth, because I was told like the inside of their mouths is so soft, and it is. And you kind of, you see this exterior of this like big horn and like armored shell, and then you look into their eyes, and you know, you touch the inside of their mouth, and you know, you touch their little ears. And we did quite a few mothers with their calves, and honestly, you just see like the inside of them and the interaction they have and the family. And you know, when they wake up, like the baby's looking for the mom and the mom's looking for the baby, and it just removes all of this stuff about money and greed and everything, and you just kind of see the natural beauty for what it is. And we should be trying to protect these at all costs, because I mean, all of the animals that we work with are, you know, they have a special place in my heart, definitely.
And they're intelligent animals. I mean, when they wake up, you just mentioned there that the mothers look for the babies and the babies look for the mothers. Do you see any other reactions about the fact that they've now lost their horns? You know, do they still recognize each other?
Yeah.
What sort of reactions do you see?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they've done some studies on this already, because obviously like the horn can be used, especially in mating, like the dominant male tends to have a bigger horn. Mm. So they were doing on this. I think that there have been some kind of research into the fact that obviously it's not the ideal solution, in the sense that the rhino is the only thing that should have its horn. You know, it shouldn't be us, it should be the rhino. But if the rhino is dying for this, then I would say that the effects of dehorning is not catastrophic enough that it would upset kind of the status quo of the animals and their ability to breed. And yes, they do still recognize each other. The babies, they do kind of like this, it's almost like a dolphin squeak.
Yeah.
And it's calling. So the mum will recognize in different ways, you know, the smell, the sound. And yeah, I mean, we saw it when they both got up together and then they kind of joined forces. But again, it's kind of like a, it's an experience, because these animals are wild. They're not used to the vet. They're not used to the vehicles. They're not used to the helicopter. You know, all of this is quite chaotic for them. But it's done in the most professional and streamlined way. And that's why it still makes a really enjoyable experience for guests when they come, because it's an opportunity for them to be up close and personal with a wild animal without it being dropped or in a cage or, you know, in a zoo or anything like that. Like, this is truly wild. It will continue to be wild. And the you're privileged to be able to touch it, because we're doing this procedure in order to protect it.
Yeah, and that's it. You know, you are doing something to help the animal. You're not just going out on safari and looking at them. You are actually actively seeking to support hippos, which is, and it's not just hippos you work with. You've also been involved with other animals in Africa, haven't you?
I mean, honestly, anything and everything. Lions, hyenas, cheetahs, leopards, elephants, rhinos, giraffe, kudu, just everything and anything. You know, it's an ecosystem. So the animals are reliant on each other. There is, you know, even vultures. Lion King's given them a bad rap, but they're definitely needed in the ecosystem. You know, they cleaning the carcasses, and you know, their stomach is like bleach, so it cleans everything. And we would have a lot more diseases introduced if we didn't have them. So everything and anything has a place. And this is something that I want to stress as well. It kind of seems like this is a commercialized thing, but it's not. It's the necessity of what needs doing. We won't do anything or run any trips where the animal doesn't need an intervention.
Yeah.
And quite often, well, things might change on the trip. It might be that we've got an emergency come in and we need to work on something. We try to stick to the plan as much as possible, but for sure, you know, this is Africa and this is in the bush and you'll be exposed to everything. And of course, on top of that, we do have the relaxing parts as well. We do go on safari. We do night drive. We work with the anti-poaching unit. There's also a canine unit that we work with out there. And we also go into the communities. We meet the school children. There's some grannies there at the moment, which are taking plastic bags and they're making like hats and bags and things out of it. And that's to kind of boost the economy of their community. So you literally see everything. But yeah, it's important to stress the reason behind this. And again, one of the reasons why I did this wasn't because, you know, it was just an opportunity I saw, but I've seen so many people that are willing to donate and are willing to get involved and, you know, want to support, and they will send their money to an organization and then they might not know what happens with it.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you're directly paying for the wildlife intervention that you get to see with your own eyes, you get to touch and you get to be part of. So there's,
yeah,
you can connect with it better. And then the aim is for that feeling that you have in that trip to go back with you to whatever country, you know, you're living in, and for you to spread the message and then for more people to come. And this is the way that we will get exposure to this real issue and to also get the work done that needs done.
It is a huge undertaking. It's interesting that you're working with the community. Have you and have the team had any backlash from the poachers or from the people that are trying to make money from these rhinos? Have you ever found yourself in an awkward position, let's say?
Personally, for me, no. And I think that's purely for the, you know, my kind of early stages in the process. I'm sure that there will be excitement to come over the years. I don't think it's something that's maybe spoken about too much. But for sure, there are tensions. And that's why it's really important to connect the communities, the landowners, you know, the natives and the animals and everything into kind of a system where we understand what the purpose for this is and how it benefits everyone involved.
Yeah.
You know, so it gives them incentive to support the process. And yeah, in terms of, I have heard stories, and of course, there's lots of stuff on the internet that you can see and read. And I'm sure there is a lot of truth in a lot of different things, but my focus isn't to kind of dwell on, there will be politics wherever you go, there will be greed wherever you go. But I think if we just keep reminding ourselves of the reason why we should be doing this and why we are, then it keeps you focused and you kind of deal with that stuff as and when it comes.
Yeah, you're very calm about it. I can see why you are adventurous. What about the animals as such? Have you ever, I know when my son, when my older son, Peter, went out to Africa, he was on an organized safari and they had a moment where an elephant almost charged him and he felt like, you know, his life was in danger. Have you ever come face to face with an awkward animal?
Yeah, I mean, this is the, for me, it's like the best part about not being charged at, but it's the nicest part to see that an animal is being an animal, you know, and it's not being, as I said, being drugged or caged or whatever. I mean, the likelihood of that happening is very slim. The people that we work with on the ground, the vets, etc., I mean, they have like 20 plus years experience in this. They can read the animal's behavior. They know the situation, they know the process. I mean, I've done it a few times now and I'm already like, checklist, this is what we need to do. So all of the safety measures are in place to prevent that.
Yeah.
Of course, we cannot predict 100% how the animal will react. But our safety is kind of priority. And then obviously the safety of the animal as well. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. there's also about knowing how to react and what to do. So we've got very experienced guides and rangers that we are with. So they are able to assess the situation, and they won't, there's like a rule in Africa, an unwritten rule, that the animals, they own the road. So when you're in the bush, like their territory, and you respect that. So we would never be kind of pushing them too much or, you know, interfering with their space. And that's what's great as well about the reserves that we work for, is that they're really strict on these kind of procedures. And that's one for the safety of the guests, but also so you don't disrupt this ecosystem that's going on. You know, we are guests in their world. And also when you're on the game viewer, which is like the vehicle, the typical safari vehicle that you'll have seen, the animals still don't really know what you are.
Yes.
So if you stick your arm out or you stick your head out, you break the shape of the vehicle, and then they're like, you look tasty. Whereas if you stay in the vehicle and you do what you should be doing, which you're prepped with at the beginning of the drive, there'll be no issues. And then obviously once the animal is safely stabilized with the medication that they've been given to do the work, everyone can get out. There are still teams on sides, you know, which have the appropriate arms and whatever they need to protect us. And then we work on the animal and then we wake it up, because it normally takes a couple of minutes for them to wake up after the medicine, and we get back into the vehicle and then we make sure everything's okay before we drive off and look for the next one.
Gosh, sounds quite exciting, Chloe. I'm just, you know, reflecting on the fact that you are only 27 and you've gone from the UK to Dubai, involved in Africa. You've changed jobs, you've set up this whole new company. You must be very proud of yourself and everything that you've accomplished in such a short time.
Yeah, I think it's something that I need to remind myself of a bit more. I'd like to think I'm modest, maybe some people don't, I'm not sure. But I have goals in my mind, and I'm the type of person that will, you know, keep doing what I need to do to get there. And like, it's not been easy. I moved as soon as I graduated at 21, you know, like fresh out of uni. I'd done a bit of traveling before. I'd studied in Australia for 6 months, but you know, I wasn't kind of brought up, as they say, on a silver spoon and was given this opportunity. I had to fight for all of this myself, and it's not easy. You know, I work really long hours, I have long days. Especially during COVID, you know, I didn't see my family for over a year.
Yeah.
My sister's just had a newborn, which I'm not going to see for another, you know, 6 months. So there are sacrifices that I've had to make. But I'm so happy with where I'm at. You know, I'm able to treat my family. I'm able to bring them out here and see my life. And I'm able to do something that I'm passionate about. And I think kind of, I do need to remind myself a little bit more of the journey that I've come on and what I've achieved, and not look too much, you know, in the future, like I need to do this next or I need to do this next, and just kind of enjoy the moment. But when I'm out in the bush, sitting around the campfire with, you know, a bottle of wine and these great people that I'm working with, and we know that we've just protected like 10 rhinos and we're going to do some lions in the morning, that just gives me all the happiness that I need. And it makes all of this work and long nights and hours worth it, definitely.
Wow, definitely. Well, I'm glad that you know, are proud of yourself, because you definitely deserve to be. And you've got all these aims for the future as well. Is there something that, you know, you particularly want to do? I know you've talked about the company that you set up, Wild Tracks. Are there any other future aims that you've got, or that, do they all set around Wild Tracks?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you age, like your priorities change.
What do you say as you age at 27? Yes, sorry, Chloe.
I've lived a lot in my, I would say like my career from 21 till 27 has been, although only 6 years, it's, I've experienced a lot. And I think when you live in a country and you don't have your family support network, you're almost like forced to deal with situations yourself. So I feel like I'm older than my age, even though I don't want to be. I need to still be living my 27 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel that, yeah, as I said, priorities kind of change. At the moment, you know, I'm fully energized and I want to kind of conquer this. I want to get like a game reserve in South Africa. I want to be able to you know, have like a rehabilitation center and stuff like that.
Wow.
But I also, something that I've learned kind of through doing this while still having a full-time job, is the biggest kind of reward, I think, is freedom. Like, I was very kind of money driven a lot through my career. So like, I need to get to the next position, I need the experience, I need to be, you know, where I should be at, whether that's a CEO or a managing director or whatever. And I think as I'm getting older, like the biggest goal for me is to be free with my time, so I can choose where I want to put my energy.
Yes.
So as I said, at the moment, kind of like tossing between the two to get this up and running, why to still earn an income, to still be able to, you know, support and see my family. So those things I need to balance. And so, yeah, at the moment, 100% efforts in Wild Tracks. Knowing my personality, I'll probably find something else to spend my time and energy on. But that's my focus. And then to obviously have some like quality family time and see my friends and kind of make up for the years that I've been here.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, it must have been very, very tough going out there at the age of 21, completely different lifestyle out in Dubai. What were some of the hardest things you found when you first moved to Dubai?
I mean, I love Dubai, and I was visiting it before I kind of moved out here. I had some godparents out here at the time. Unfortunately, they've had to go back to the UK now. But I had them in the beginning, which was great. It was kind of like a bit of home comfort. And I'd been on holiday a few times before. And it's really unusual because Dubai is totally different from what I'm kind of doing in South Africa. And I've always said to people, like, I have almost these two like personalities, like the luxury high life of Dubai and all the, you know, excitement that comes with that. And then like Chloe in like, you know, jogging bottoms covered in elephant poo with my hair tied up on my head. I can balance the two really well, and both of them give me like equal pleasures. And there's so much more to Dubai than people see on the internet or just see, you know, the city and, you know, Burj Khalifa, Burj Al Arab. There's like mountains that we go hiking in. There's wadis that we go swimming in. There's the mosques that we can go and visit. And there's such a nice expat community here. And I've made friends for I think when I first moved here, just the administration of moving to a new country, I'm sure anyone has dealt with the pain of, you know, finding a car, finding a house, setting up a bank account, visas, and all of these things. But now when I look back, I'm like, it really wasn't a lot of stress. It was just, I was young and it's the first time doing it. But now I see like Dubai as my home. Obviously, the UK, I would say, is my second home, even though it was my first one. But I've got my family unit here with my 5 rescue cats, which I shouldn't be advertising because I'm never going to be able to settle down with anyone if they think that I have 5 cats. And then, of course, South Africa, I'm making it my third home. So I'm a little, my heart's a little bit everywhere in the world at the moment.
And you've got enough energy to do that as well. You've got a multifaceted life, Chloe.
Yes, it is exhausting, but I wouldn't have it any other way. I would be so bored if I was, you know, just at home, and I'm sure I'd be commuting to London every day, and which again is a life for some. But for me, I'm always on it. I want something new, something different. It might be my downfall eventually, but at the moment it's keeping me entertained. So I'll go with it.
Well, it's wonderful, Chloe. Well, thank you very much, Chloe. It's been an absolute delight talking to you. I've still got a picture of this little, you know, cyclist struggling along on her Dutch bike trying to brake all that time ago. Did you remember?
Yeah.
Round the lake where you had to brake with the back pedals. I think none of you were used to that, which was fun. But that was a long time ago.
I honestly don't, like, it feels like another life. You know, I mean, as I said, I'm still in contact with people, but when I see memories that come up on Facebook of like the pictures of me, I was just like, oh my goodness, how did anyone take me seriously in the bright green and white colours and just like
a Welland city.
Yes, exactly. But it was some good times. I mean, Assen, Holland and stuff, it was so much fun. And I've got a cat here.
Ah, let's see the cat.
It's got grubby eyes at the moment. This is Pippin.
Oh, how gorgeous. This is Pippin.
Yeah, he's my latest rescue. He's the only man of the house, and he acts like it. So he's my little prince. The others are all girls. They're not interested in me whatsoever at the moment.
That's the way to do it. Anyway, Chloe, I just got to asking you, I'd forgotten now, I just got to talking to you a bit about It Was Another Life when we were talking about Asen and how much you'd moved on.
Yes, terrible colours. No, my dad actually still coaches down there. So sometimes he'll be like, oh, why don't you come along? But I don't recognise anyone anymore. But yeah, definitely I've got some fantastic pictures in the green, white and black stripes in Asen. It does seem like another life ago, but it was, again, like, what opportunity, you know, what an amazing opportunity we had, like, at such a young age to go to another country and to compete in something that we were enjoying. And it's such a good balance, you know. It was like the racing, and then it was also like the barbecues in the evening. And perhaps I was a little bit too focused on the barbecues in the evening and the going out, and not so much on the cycling. But hey, it worked out in the end for me anyway, so I won't beat myself up.
And you've got, I mean, I wouldn't know of you. You've got such good friends. It's only because my children became friendly with you and they've visited you in Dubai as well.
Yeah, I know.
Which is quite something.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very, very much for coming on here. Is there anything you feel I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
Not at all. I think we covered most of it. And yeah, I mean, I can add the Instagram handles if you don't mind. Obviously Conservation Clo and Wild Tracks. And if anyone is interested, it's not just for like the UAE. I don't want to sound like this is a sales pitch, because it's not. But I'm not just taking people from the UAE. I'm taking people who are interested and want to help this. So any exposure, shares, likes, whatever will help me out. And I'm just really grateful that you messaged me, because it's been such a long time since we've spoken, you know, as you say, like, what, 15 years ago in Holland. And it's great to be able to get this cause out and listen to. So thank you so much for thinking of me and having me on.
And thank you very much. It's been an absolute delight. I always wonder how the children that my children grew up with grow up into the adults they are. And it's quite a delight actually talking to you and seeing the grown-up Chloe. So thank you very much indeed, Chloe.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I will be following very, very closely.
Thank you. Hopefully you'll be on a trip. Come along.
don't know about that. I am
next year. We'll...
I will think about it. My husband's been trying to persuade me to go on a safari for years, and I just, no, I am not interested. Yours is something different.
Yeah, we'll change that. I've got Pippin crying in the background. He's not happy with your answer.
Thank you, and do enjoy what's left of your evening, Chloe.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And you.
Very sobering talking to Chloe, and controversial in many ways. But if you're interested in finding out more, do follow Chloe at Wild Tracks on Instagram, and also Chloe Conservation also on Instagram, and check the show notes. I'm sure Chloe will be fascinated to hear from you, and maybe she might even persuade me to go on a safari. Thank you once again to you, our listeners, and we do hope you'll join us next time when we will be talking to someone else who visited Africa and it has changed his life. Till then, take care. Oh, and for any of you still listening, huge congratulations to my number one son, Peter Dibben, and Chloe Gilman, who've been married a year now. Fantastic time we had just over a year ago in Crete. And yes, now my second son is also married to the beautiful Abby May. You'll be hearing a lot more about that and seeing a lot more of those pictures on our Instagram and social feeds very soon. Until next time, bye.